According to ancient Hindu and Buddhist beliefs, cumulus clouds are the spiritual cousins of elephants, which is why the animals are worshipped, with a view to bringing rain after India's scorching summer heat. Megha, meaning cloud in classical Hindi, is the name used to address elephants in these prayers. The Sanskrit creation myths describe how elephants created at the beginning of time were white, had wings to fly, could change their shape at will, and had the power to bring rain. In Hellenistic and Roman art, emperors were often depicted with a crown of rays, known as radiate. This signified their association with the sun gods, Helios and Sol, and was also used as a sign of posthumous divinity. With the rise of Christianity, the symbol was dropped in place of a circular halo, called a nimbus. The rays of the radiate were felt to be too pagan in association. The circular nimbus was used in Christian art to signify a subject's spirituality until the early Renaissance, when painting discs over people's heads began the general move toward naturalism. Raiden, the Japanese god of thunder and lightning, is said to create lightning. He looks like a red demon, has sharp claws, and is fond of eating human navels. Not wanting to take any chances, young children in Japan are known to put their hands over their belly buttons when they hear thunder. All of these stories, and a lot more, can be found in The Cloud Spotter's Guide, The Science, History, and Culture of Clouds. And today, we get to speak to its author and founder of the Cloud Appreciation Society, Gavin Prieter-Pinney. The Washington Post wrote that The Cloud Spotter's Guide is thoroughly readable, never mind the silver lining. It turns out, the cloud is the thing. And this week, the cloud is indeed the thing, drawn from Parsha Beha Alotcha, in which the Israelites wander through the desert led by a pillar of cloud during the day and a pillar of fire by night. So naturally, we wanted to unpack the nature of clouds, their relationship to ancient biblical texts, and why we project our own narratives onto them. Humans have been fascinated by clouds since the beginning of time, so we thought it would be nice to speak to the guy who literally wrote the book on them. On a totally different note, I know there's been a lot of heat around the Jewish space, around the politics of the Middle East, and I just want to recognize the fact that we haven't covered the topic at all on the show. It's really important for me that when we do so thoughtfully rather than reactionarily, and that I personally do all the necessary homework before engaging publicly on the topic. So, as long as you know that I'm not ignoring it, and that I'm doing my own work to engage with all the necessary topics surrounding these crucial conversations that need our attention. Okay, on to the show. Welcoming back Rabbi Matt Green from Congregation Beth Elohim in Brooklyn, New York. Rabbi Matt, good to be with you.
Always a pleasure, Raviv.
And I am so happy to be in conversation with Gavin Prieter-Pinney, founder of the Cloud Appreciation Society and author of The Cloud Spotter's Guide, The Science, History, and Culture of Clouds, joining us from Somerset, England. Welcome, Gavin.
Hey, Raviv. How's it going?
I'm so good today and so excited. I've been really excited about this episode. My partner Julia has been exceptionally excited about this episode. Really, just everyone is excited about this episode. So doing great. In this week's Torah portion, we get to explore both the science and study of clouds, as well as the role in religious history. But before we get into any text-based stuff, Gavin, could you give us some basics? What exactly is a cloud?
Well, a cloud is water. Okay, so it's water up in the atmosphere, and you're going to say, well, it doesn't look like water because it's white and it looks solid. Well, sometimes the water is in droplet form, and sometimes it's in ice crystal form. But the really important thing about a cloud is, of course, the water's not all together in one big clump. It's in lots of tiny bits. And that is why the cloud appears the way it does. It's why a cloud appears white, because all those tiny particles of water, they scatter the light. And in the same way that ice crystals in snow scatter the light and appear white to us, the same way that foam on a breaking wave scatters the light in all direction and appears white to us, well, a cloud, all those particles, whether they're droplets or ice crystals, they scatter the light in all directions, and that appears to us as something white floating in the sky, seemingly effortlessly in the blue.
You've been thinking about clouds for a long time now, I imagine.
Well, I started the Cloud Appreciation Society about 16 years ago now, something like that. But of course, I've been thinking about clouds since I was a kid. In fact, that's when most of us start thinking about clouds, I think, because that's when we get transfixed by the strangeness of them. And it's also when we first get stimulated by the shapes we see in them. They are invitations to our imaginations. And when you're a kid and you've got time on your hands, the only deadline is bedtime. Well, that's when you kind of can really go with that invitation from clouds. You can allow your imagination to drift along in the breeze, find shapes in them. And I think we all, therefore, form a relationship with clouds when we're young. It's one that's deep within us. And sometimes it gets reawoken when we're older, when we're grown up. That's what the Cloud Appreciation Society is there to do, to reawaken that early, deep, profound relationship we have with the sky.
Oh, I can't wait to talk more about the society, about its founding, and of all of these ideas. And I think that all sets up nicely for a Parsha summary. What do you think, Rabbi Matt?
I think that's right. And I think we might just dive in by talking about clouds. And obviously, there are so many things in this Parsha. It's a mishmash of different laws and so forth, as it usually is. But clouds feature prominently in this week's Torah portion, more specifically, one cloud. You may know from the book of Exodus, which we read many weeks, I guess months ago, that God sends a cloud to be with the Israelites as they wander in the desert. And it's mentioned a couple times in Exodus, but here in this week's Torah portion, we get even more of a description of what's going on. So to recap, Parashat Beha'alotcha, which we're looking at this week, finds the Israelites at the foot of Mount Sinai. They've been there for a year, roughly, and they're about to wander. They're about to start their journey, which is maybe about 40 years in the desert. And they're pretty anxious. And we'll say a few words about their anxiety in just a moment, but to calm them down, God basically sends a cloud to be with them, to show them the way, essentially. And the idea is that whenever they are camped, the cloud will stay in that camp. And whenever it's time to move, the cloud will disappear or will actually move in a direction and help the Israelites figure out where they need to go. But I love thinking about how a cloud isn't always a cloud, because here, it may be that the cloud is actually God, or who knows what. The cloud isn't just something you see in the sky. Here, it has a spiritual purpose. Also, I'm really intrigued by the idea of a cloud being water, because one important thing about this cloud is that the cloud actually has fire in its core. And so this special biblical cloud is a kind of mythic or divine fire that is surrounded by mist, surrounded by cloudiness, and then it moves to demonstrate to the people where to go. And one other aside I would just throw into this mix, because every Parsha has so many different pieces within it, the Torah portion begins by talking about the menorah that should exist in the temple when it is built, and in this case, the tabernacle in the desert. And the menorah is a source of light in an otherwise dark place. That's the beginning of the Torah portion. And then we get this piece about clouds. And then the Torah portion ends with all kinds of bitterness and anxiety on the part of the people, where they freak out because they don't have meat. They want to eat meat, and all they have is manna. You'd think they'd be satisfied with manna, but so be it. They complain, and we get a vision of the Israelites as a supremely anxious people, right? So this whole cliche about Jews and anxiety runs deep, and perhaps it starts here. And so I think to take the light and the darkness at the beginning of the Parsha and the end, where we get this vision of the Israelites as anxious about food and needing direction, that's how it ends. In the middle, we get this section about clouds. And the cloud is really supposed to be direction. It's supposed to be some way of calming the people down so they have some physical manifestation of the divine. They feel like they're not alone. They feel like they have some direction. And a cloud is never just a cloud, fine. But in this case, it's supposed to be a vision of where to go.
And I just want to make sure I understand that during the day, God is taking the shape of a cloud, and at night that switches to kind of a ball of fire, or are they intertwined?
Well, as usual, it's kind of hard to say exactly, but the idea is that there is fire in the middle of the cloud, and that during the day when it's light, you don't see the fire, all you see is the cloud. But at night, when it's dark, it's the fire that emerges as the most prominent part of this being or this entity. And just for what it's worth, commentaries abound about was it fire, was it water, was it a cloud? And it led the rabbis basically to say that in general, because it was the cloud that was more potent than the fire, and it was only visible in the daytime, that the Israelites would move in the mornings, because that's when they could see the cloud moving.
Got it. I guess I'm curious from a scientific perspective, Gavin, is there any basis for a cloud that has some fire enveloped into it or switches into fire? Do we have fiery clouds? Is that a thing? Or could that be lightning? What could be the scientific basis for this, if that exists?
A couple of things come to mind. I mean, yeah, lightning has to be the first one. I mean, a pillar of cloud that suggests a cloud that is tall. And the tallest of the 10 main cloud types, and we divide clouds up into 10 types, is the cumulonimbus cloud. This is the storm cloud. In fact, when the list of 10 clouds were first set out in 1896, in this book called the International Cloud Atlas, the cumulonimbus was number 9 in that list, the tallest cloud. That was where we got the phrase to be on cloud 9. And so this pillar of cloud immediately makes me think of a storm cloud. It is and people talk about it as the king or queen of clouds, because it is the mighty one that's so enormous, and the manifestation of the power of our atmosphere. The cumulonimbus, being the storm cloud, is the breeder of thunder and lightning. So I guess that's the first thing that occurs. Lightning within a cloud is a little like fire, and certainly lightning strikes from a cumulonimbus cloud down to the ground can set off wildfires in certain conditions. So there's one link between fire and clouds, but there is another, which is the pyrocumulus cloud, which is a type of cloud that has really been born of fire. So if you have a wildfire taking place, above it, you'll get lots and lots of smoke particles thrown up into the atmosphere. But in addition to that, a lot of moisture will be given off by the burning of all this vegetation. That moisture rises up into the sky, and that can form into the droplets of cloud. And the droplets of cloud that form onto all the tiny smoke particles being billowed up into the atmosphere, and you can get what's known as this pyrocumulus cloud, or a cloud known as flammagenitus. It's born of fire. And so a cumulonimbus cloud could actually have started off being produced by flames, by fire, and that can then lead to this storm cloud, which then produces lightning and then sets off more wildfires elsewhere. So there is a connection between clouds and fire.
Zooming out a bit, Gavin, could you tell us some of the incredible and unexpected story of the formation and founding of the Cloud Appreciation Society?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it came about without too much planning or preparation in a way. I had always liked clouds. I always thought that the sky is an overlooked part of nature. That sounds like a wrong metaphor, but it's a part of nature that we don't pay quite enough attention to, because it's always there. And certainly here in the UK, where we get a lot of clouds, people complain about them. You have written into the English language negative associations with clouds. People talk about somebody who's down or depressed having a cloud hanging over them. Or when there's bad news in store, there's a cloud on the horizon. They get a bad rap, put it that way. And so I've always thought that that's a shame. And that when you stop to think about it, the sky, the clouds are the most evocative part of nature, the most dynamic and like almost poetic aspect of nature, because of this ever-changing quality they have, this ephemeral quality. So I'd like talking about clouds to friends. And a friend of mine started a literary festival down in Cornwall in the southwest of England about 16 years or 17 years ago, something like that. She said, "Why don't you do a talk about clouds? You like them so much." I said, "Listen, I've not written a book or anything. She said, "Don't worry, we're just starting this literary festival. We don't care if you've written a book or not. You know, we're desperate for speakers." So I was like, okay. And I thought, how do I, you know, this was before I had any society, before I'd written a book or anything. I thought, how do I get people to come along to a cloud talk? I thought, well, I'll give it just an unusual name. So I called it the inaugural lecture of the Cloud Appreciation Society, just because I thought it sounded like an interesting, like the sort of talk I'd like to go along to. Really, not much more than that. Everyone, it was really full. And then everyone came up to me afterwards and said, "Hey, how do I join?" So I thought, wait a minute. Actually, now that I think about this, there's a value in something that reminds us about a part of our surroundings so obvious, so everyday, so mundane almost, that we've become blind to it and blind to its beauty. Something that serves as a tap on the shoulder to re-engage us with that everyday experience. There's a value in that. That's how it began.
You talked about some of the negative associations that people speak about clouds, or how it's included in language. And you directed a documentary for the BBC called Cloud Spotting. And there's this really funny and resonant part at the beginning where someone is talking about having gone on a vacation that was incredible because there wasn't a cloud in the sky, which visibly disappoints you. What would you say are the primary reasons why some people and cultures have negative associations with clouds?
I think it's partly because, like I say, we don't normally notice them, but we do notice them when they change the light down here on the surface. So a low cloud, when it gets between us and the sun, it casts a shadow. Not the high clouds so much, but the low clouds do. You notice this change in light, you look up and there's a cloud in front of the sun. And so we come to sort of associate them with the obstructions in life. And of course, you know, religious or not religious, we all deep down have always known that the ultimate fire, the ultimate bringer of warmth and energy to our planet, is the sun. So anything that gets between us and the sun, you could think of it as, you know, a problem. You could think of it as something you don't like. But that is really to have a restricted understanding and appreciation of what's going on, because the sun creates the clouds. The warmth of the sun produces the movements of air in our lower atmosphere. It lifts the moisture from the surface up into the air. It causes rising columns, and all these movements lead to the production of clouds. It's a system that is intertwined. So there's no opposition between clouds and the sun, the energy of the sun. The two are, you know, in this intimate embrace and always have been.
Simpatico relationship between the two. Rabbi Matt, you know, this is a parsha where clouds obviously represent God or vice versa. Is there any evidence in Torah of negative association with clouds? Is that a thing? Or are they always kind of a bringer of good tidings?
You know, it's an interesting question. I can't think of anything that's negative, but it is occasionally scary. So we've been talking about the positive associations with this pillar of cloud that God sends as a symbol of God's presence. But sometimes God's presence is actually quite scary. And specifically at the moment at Mount Sinai, I guess this would be a year ago in the biblical chronology, there's a moment when the mountain shakes and there is a smoke. And it's not referred to as an anan, it's not called a cloud there, but it is referred to in the context of thunder and lightning and some kind of ethereal smokiness that really terrifies the people. And I think the connection to thunder and lightning makes it clear that it's some kind of cloud, though it doesn't use the word cloud. It doesn't say anan. And then Moses tells the people, don't be afraid. So though I can't think of any examples of, you know, biblical Hebrew expressions like a cloudy day representing something negative, it is clear that clouds were sometimes scary in as much as they could represent the awesome, perhaps scary power of the divine.
That's reminding me of a section in your book, Gavin, that talks about, I want to make sure I'm getting this right. Isn't it a pilot that had to eject from a seat and got caught in this insane storm for something like 40 minutes? Am I getting that right?
That's right. Yeah, this was in the 1950s. And he was a Navy pilot in the U.S. He was flying his jet over the top of one of these cumulonimbus storm clouds. He was called Colonel William Rankin. And his engine seized right when he was over the top of this enormous cloud, the tallest of the clouds. And it just, all the dials went to zero and there was not much that you were going to be able to do in that situation, he quickly realized. And so he pulled the lever and ejected out up at around 48,000 feet or something like that. So if I remember rightly off the top of my head. So and he was just wearing a light summer flying suit, no pressured, you know, air, oxygen or anything like that. So then he had a rather unpleasant descent, let's put it that way. It wouldn't have been a lot of fun at the best of times, but a lot worse when you're falling right down through the churning, icy core of this enormous monster of a cloud below. And he lived to tell the tale, so he wrote a book about it, actually, and recounted the whole story of falling into it, the darkness that as he got enveloped into the upper reaches of the cloud, and how he was tumbling through the air. He was, the pressure changes had caused him to appear in a state of advanced pregnancy. You know, his stomach was extended so much. He was vomiting from the pressure changes and the spinning, and then, you know, the thunder and the lightning started. He began to be pummeled by hailstones. The lightning, the thunder was, they were explosions, not so much like a sound, but more like a physical explosion. He was bleeding in his ears from these pressure changes as a result of the lightning. He eventually emerged out of the base of the cloud and landed, because his parachute did manage to automatically open, which had been some doubt. Then he landed in some trees and merely hurt his leg, I think. But It turned out, you know, that descent should have taken him 10, 12 minutes from the height he was falling from. But it took him around about 40 minutes, 40, 42 minutes, because he'd checked his watch like a good pilot would as he ejected. And he'd just been stuck in the middle of this cloud going up and down, which is actually how a hailstone grows. It gets caught in these churning currents, rising and then falling and rising and falling, each time being coated by another layer of ice as it goes up into the icy upper reaches of the cloud. And he was like a human hailstone. So yeah, not a descent you'd want to wish on anyone, really.
I mean, that's a good example of a biblical cloud story, if there was one. And it makes sense why we have these associations of fear, but also of wonder, that being perhaps a more extreme version. You know, clouds are all around us, and they always have been, including in the arts. And I'm thinking about many religious paintings that include clouds in such a grand way as to effectively make them a central character. Do you know what are some of the earliest inclusions of clouds in the arts as more than just a backdrop?
I mean, it's really quite late on that they become the central focus. And that's really with the Romantic painters, by which I mean, I suppose, painters like John Constable or William Turner, J.M.W. Turner here in the UK, someone like Church in the US. I mean, these painters brought weather, clouds to the sort of the starring roles. Before that, most of the time they were the backdrops, and they would be serving a purpose of some sort. That purpose might be one of inspiring awe and shock, or this kind of sublime effect that could certainly be very effective if it was a religious painting. They might serve the purpose of something more practical. You know, an angel or a prophet or Jesus or Moses might need to sit on something if they're elevated from the ground. So clouds are quite helpful as these sofas of the saints. They are between us and the divine world up there. And before humans were able to go up in a hot air balloon and have a look at what's actually on top of the clouds, well, they were this sort of magical realm that, you know, you imagined. If you look up to your gods, as we always seem to have done, what do you see? Clouds. And so we naturally associate clouds with the divine. And I think we always have done.
I'm also thinking about the, like you're talking about, the inclusion in kind of ancient narrative myths. And you tell a story in the book of the Greek mythological story relating clouds to the creation of centaurs. Do you remember that piece as well?
God, no, I don't.
That's great. There's just I'm not going to be able to tell it well, but just so Matt knows,
it's like, look it up. It's so long ago,
isn't it?
I wrote that bit.
It's like one of Zeus is jealous that somebody's going to sleep with one of his wives, and so creates a cloud to look like his wife to test this guy, who then does have sex with the cloud. So he realizes he was going to sleep with his wife, kills the guy, but then the cloud gives birth to a centaur later on, which is a part of the lesson in not copulating with clouds.
Yeah, Zeus, Jupiter was Zeus. Did
Jupiter, right?
Yeah. I mean, the Romans called him Jupiter, and they he was god of thunder, and so would be able to command the clouds to do what he wanted, and generally didn't use them for all that great purposes. I mean, one time he disguised himself as a cloud in order to seduce Io, one of the priestesses of his wife Hera. Depending on which text you read, he seduced her or raped her, but either way, he was disguised in a cloud to kind of hide him. Now, this idea of clouds being something that hides, that obscures, I think is really crucial to the symbolism of a cloud representing the presence of God on earth, because it both is a contradictory thing, a cloud. Like we said at the start, it's made of tiny bits, but it looks like a thing. It looks so solid, but you can't touch it. So that contradictory idea is a great way to express the contradiction of something divine having a presence on earth. But also, there's something unknown because our vision is clouded, is hidden. We don't know what's in the middle of it. You know, it's the cloud of unknowing. It's representational of what is beyond our ability to know. And also, the sky is the least governable, most unpredictable part of nature, and therefore is beyond our realm of control. It still is. That's one reason why people complain about clouds, because they ruin their barbecues or they pour down on their weddings or whatever it is. That is one reason why one might associate clouds with the divine, with the powers that are beyond our own.
Why is this Friday night different from all other Friday nights? One Table is on a mission to help you make every Friday night feel special. They're here to help 20 and 30 somethings find the magic of taking rest from the week by connecting them with a Shabbat dinner. Whether you want to request a seat at the table for an in-person outdoor dinner, join the table virtually from anywhere around the world, or tap into Shabbat rituals on Instagram, One Table makes it easy to find the moment of pause that's right for you. Check out onetable.org to build your dream Friday night every week.
Rabbi Mack, could you walk us through some perhaps other places in Torah where these connections exist?
Well, I mean, I was just thinking about exactly what you're saying, Gavin. And in this week's Torah portion, there is another example of clouds. Maybe it's the same cloud, or maybe it's a different one. But in Numbers 11, verse 25, God actually appears in a cloud to Moses. And famously, God doesn't really talk to people face to face. God appears in other ways. Moses, in one part of the Torah, is the only person that's able to actually talk to God face to face, but that's in a different time. Here, what allows God to speak to Moses is the fact that God is coming down in a cloud. So again, the cloud is perhaps mysterious or seems divine, but in fact, the cloud here is what is allowing God to appear on earth because God is concealed. Here, it's about the cloudiness of God. And in general, people can't see God, of course, but what allows God to be present is by concealing God's self in this cloud. And similarly, that same verse plays around with the word ruach, which means spirit. And when God appears, the spirit of God is with Moses, and then in this case, the 70 elders. Do it that way, you will. But point is that ruach also means wind. It means spirit, but it also means wind. And we find that in English too. There's a connection between breathing, for instance, and spirit, right? So air is connected to spirit in all kinds of ways. But it is intriguing that when the spirit rests upon these people, whether it's Moses or the elders, as a form of prophecy, it comes in the form of this cloud because it, in some ways, protects the people from the power of God. So it's exactly what you're talking about.
There's another point to make that I think relates to that, which is clouds are essentially ephemeral things. They are fleeting, they're momentary, they're passing. They appear and then they're gone. You might think that would be kind of the last thing that would be appropriate as a symbol or a representation of something eternal. But of course, there's a sort of link between the two. It's the very ephemeral nature of clouds, the fact that they're just here and gone and here and gone, and yet they've always been the backdrop to human existence, means that they both represent the most temporary things in life and also the most eternal. So I think, again, you've got the contradiction going on with clouds. They're such brilliantly contradictory things. So it doesn't surprise me at all that they would feature as a symbol for representing divine beings down here on Earth.
And also, just on that note, that they've really been present since the very beginning. In Genesis 1, the first chapter of the Torah, of the Bible, we get not a cloud, although in many representations of the creation story, obviously, we imagine there to be clouds, but we do get that ruach, that wind of God. And we understand creation in terms of air and air formations, even if the word anan, meaning cloud, does not appear. So again, it really runs deep in our tradition.
And so much of it comes down to one simple fact of science, which is that water is unique on our planet as the only substance that can be found within the natural conditions of our atmosphere in the three states of solid, liquid, and gas. So nothing else, no other kind of substances are naturally found in those three states. And water can shift between those states seemingly with such ease. Only the slightest changes in temperature, it can change between them. And the crucial thing is, one of them, the gas form of water, well, it's invisible. It's a gas. I mean, it's in every breath you breathe out. So the water is in a constant dance with the slightest changes in temperature between invisibility and visibility. Because when it forms into little droplets or it forms into tiny ice crystals, then we see it as the cloud. The temperature changes ever so slightly and it shifts back effortlessly into this invisible gas form. This is why clouds seem magical. This is why they seem representations of, or at least they seem like perfect metaphors for ideas, for emotions. They seem like these shifting expressions on the face of the atmosphere. It all comes down to that one simple, unique quality of water.
I mean, I can see so many resonances with how mystics, for instance, might see in all of this metaphors for the divine. It's like especially being hidden and then being revealed. I'm kind of wondering, this is kind of embarrassing, but they don't teach this stuff in rabbinical school. Water doesn't go anywhere, meaning like it takes different shapes, but it's always around. In other words, that the air that we're breathing and also the water we're drinking is made up of the same particles that were water thousands of years ago, millions of years ago. Is that right?
Yeah. And it's in, you know, the water cycle is this circular motion of water rising off oceans and rivers and lakes because of the warmth of the sun causing it to evaporate. You know, the water in the ocean is salty, but when the when it evaporates off the surface, the salt is left behind and you just get the water molecules lifting off. They then lift up in the air. The lower part of our atmosphere has varying amounts of water as one of the gases, like oxygen and nitrogen. This gas form of water is one of the gases in air that mixes around, and every now and then something changes and it forms into droplets. And then sometimes, if conditions are right, those droplets grow and the cloud lifts and they start to freeze up in the top. And then that is the beginning, in a lot of parts of the world, that is the beginning of the process of rain, that freezing up at the top of the cloud. It then causes the ice crystals to grow up there. They become larger, they start to fall, and then they perhaps either land as snow or they land as rain if they melt on the way down. The point being, though, comes back down to Earth, makes its way down the rivers, into the aquifers under the ground, eventually back into the oceans. It's a circular motion we learn about in geography in school, and it is the same substances, the same molecules going round and round and round in circles.
I don't know anything about your spiritual background, Gavin, but it seems like the way that you're talking about clouds, and in this case, water and earth and air and so many things, is almost spiritual. And it's not hard to see why, because all of these facts of science that you're throwing out, the natural world, are beautiful metaphors for something divine, the idea of a circle and a return. And also, I keep thinking as you're talking about the three states that water can find itself in, one of which being gas, and that's most relevant for clouds here, is the idea that God appears in Judaism as Hu Haya, Hu Hove, Hu Yihye, which means God was, is, and will be. Jews famously don't really like talking about God because we all think different things about God, but the one thing that we can say with any certainty is that God is eternity in our tradition. The four-letter name for God means God was, is, and will be. It's a form of the to-be verb. And I see in what you're saying about water in these three forms as the three states of God, essentially. And so now we're really becoming like mystics in Sfat in the 16th century, and this is taking a turn. But I appreciate the way that you're making me rethink water and clouds as it relates to the divine in Judaism writ large, beyond just this Torah portion.
There are so many stories to make sense of our place here in the world. I see religions as being one way of making sense of the world and our place in the world and what happens to us. Science is another. You'll get people arguing, vociferously about which one's wrong and which one's right and which one's more the truth and which one's not. I think if you were to just take a massive step back, zoom right out from us, our little planet here, floating through the universe, you'd see that there's stories. And science is a story that keeps on being revised. What was absolutely certain in the time of Aristotle sounds ridiculous now. What was certain, in medieval times, we think of a barbaric, the what people would do for medical procedures and so on. Science, and it's not to say that at the time it was, at the time, science is it. That is the truth. It's our truth. But it's a truth that's constantly revised and constantly changed and is constantly rethought. So I do think of science as a story that makes sense of the world. And one, the telling of that story is very different from the telling of stories in religions. The resonance that it has for people emotionally is very different from the resonance that religions have for people. But I think, if you really step back from humanity and have a look from afar, it's another story to make sense of our world.
Rabbi Matt, one of the names of the Messiah in Judaism is Bar Nifli, which means son of a cloud, which for the record, I'm going to try to make into some kind of Vogue profanity. But what do you make of that name and its meaning? And am I even pronouncing it correctly?
Yeah, you are. I mean, yes.
Right.
But it could be Barnifli or Barnafli, as far as I can see here in various texts. That idea doesn't necessarily mean son of a cloud so much as son of the fallen. And in order to understand that, you need to understand a couple other things, which are totally relevant to this conversation. There is a connection that the rabbis make in the Talmud between Sukkot, meaning the booths that Jews erect for themselves to dwell in for a week every fall after Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur during the holiday of Sukkot. Those booths are supposed to represent the booths that the Israelites lived in the desert. The rabbis of the Talmud understand the Sukkot, the booths that the Israelites lived in the desert, actually to have been clouds, and clouds of God. So they weren't just tents, which is often how we think about them. As the people were in the desert, they were actually some kind of mythic, divine, cloud-like structure that could protect them. And so it's with that understanding of Sukkah as a cloud-like structure or a place where the cloud of God's glory was present, because that's how the rabbis talk about it. These Sukkot were booths where the clouds represented God's glory. Once we understand that, we can see that in the prophet Amos, there is a prophecy that at some point in the future, there will yet again be a fallen booth of David. When the booth of David is re-erected, meaning the Sukkah, or the let's say the cloud booth of King David is re-erected, that will be a symbol of the Messianic age. Now, I realize that was all very complicated, but where the idea of Barnafli or Barnifli comes from is that that's like the Hebrew word nafal, to fall down. And so the Sukkah, this cloud-like Sukkah structure of King David, had fallen down, and it will one day be re-erected when the Messiah comes. And so in this pretty obscure text that, Raviv, I'm actually very impressed that you found, it is, the Messiah is referred to as Barnafli, in reference to re-erecting this Sukkah of clouds that once existed. And so that's where that comes from. Also, for what it's worth, as far as I can tell from Steinsaltz, who is a very famous Talmud commentator, he says that it actually has nothing to do with any of that, but Nafli is derived from a Greek word meaning cloud. So who knows? Maybe, Gavin, you know if there's any connection to Nafli or Nifli in Greek?
Yeah, I mean, there's nephology. Nephology is the study of clouds, and that comes from the Greek. What is the word? There would be a Greek word for cloud, but we use Latin mostly in the cloud terms. But there's obviously a Greek word for cloud that's nephesol. I don't know.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. And everyone should know this, everyone listening, that very frequently the rabbis of the Talmud will see a word that they don't understand, and that's usually because it comes from Greek and not Hebrew. And then they make up a very complicated explanation from something obscure that no one's ever heard about to be Hebrew. But really, I guess that term comes from Greek, Raviv. So, but now you know. Now we have it.
We like the making things complicated.
But I mean, Latin is usually the language that's used in the cloud world. The classifications of clouds all use Latin. So these names we've heard of, like cumulus and cirrus and stratus, they're all Latin words. And they often refer to just the way the cloud looks. So cumulus is the Latin for a clump or a stack or a heap. It's where we get the word accumulation from. The cirrus cloud, which is the high wispy one, that comes from the Latin for curl or lock of hair, because they look like kind of straight hair, maybe flowing in the wind. Stratus is a layer or blanket. So these terms, so many of them are nothing more than people going, look, that one, it's got lots of holes in it. And then they say, yeah, that's because it's the lachrymosus cloud, which means full of holes in Latin. So you say it in Latin because it makes you sound more grown up. Sounds like you're talking something, you're talking science, when actually it's nothing more than that same act which we did when we were kids, pointing up in the sky and finding shapes.
Gavin Prater-Penny, founder of the Cloud Appreciation Society, thank you so much for hanging out with us, discussing clouds, discussing Torah, and figuring out where they intersect. I really appreciate your time.
No problem. It's really great. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Rabbi Matt Green, thank you for being here this week. Always a pleasure to be in conversation with you.
Likewise. Shabbat Shalom.
To all of our listeners, Shabbat Shalom. I wanted to make a quick note that Rabbi Matt gave me credit for finding the text on Son of a Cloud. That credit belongs to our producer extraordinaire, Evan, who is working pretty much every day on this show out of the goodness of his heart. To help support Evan's great findings, make sure to check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/thestudy. The Study is produced by Evan Scott Nicholas and me, Raviv Ullman. My co-host today was Rabbi Matt Green. And our guest was Gavin Prater-Penny. Artwork by Julia Pott. We'll see you next week.